Hello and welcome to Business Daily from the BBC. I'm Manuela Zaragoza. Coming up on International Women's Day, we're looking at the forgotten female pioneers of the tech sector.
There was one woman I know who did a solid and very senior technical management role. And I don't think her husband really knew that she worked. She was working on the sly.
We ask how and when the men took over in tech. And should the internet be engineered to redress gender bias?
If we're going to do that algorithmically, we have to be very careful about how do we control it, who controls it.
That's all here in Business Daily from the BBC. Women make up a very small part of the computing sector, less than a quarter of the jobs across the world. It's easy then to forget that once upon a time, computing was seen as a woman's job and that women were key to the sector's development. In a moment, we'll speak to a woman who played a leading role. But first, one of the earliest pioneers of computing was Ada Lovelace, back in the early 19th century. She's credited with devising the first ever computer program. Today, some even refer to her as a prophet of the computer age, and more poetically, perhaps, an enchantress of numbers. A couple of years ago, the British mathematician Hannah Fry made a documentary about her for the BBC.
Ada's mother didn't want her daughter to become like her famous poet father, Lord Byron. So Ada studied maths. She worked with Charles Babbage on his idea for something he called an analytical engine, the blueprint of the world's first computer.
But Ada realised the machine could be much more than a calculator, making the conceptual leap to computers 100 years before they were built.
This is all the more remarkable when you consider that Ada Lovelace lived in a time when women were banned from attending university or pursuing careers. Prejudice against women was so strong that Ada's accomplishments went unrecognised. She was a remarkable woman and yet still didn't manage to change society's preconceptions of women and what they were capable of. Looking back through time, though, you can see the impact that Ada had on me and other women in the sciences.
The British mathematician Hannah Fry speaking about Ada Lovelace. Those other women she mentions include Dame Stephanie Shirley. In the early days of programming in the UK in the 1960s, computing was all about women, and Dame Stephanie Shirley was its leading light. In 1962, she set up a female-only company called Freelance Programmers. And a couple of weeks ago, Dame Shirley popped into our studios here in central London to tell me how it all started.
You needed mathematics in the early days of computing, but I didn't really start it in a scientific mode at all. I started it as a crusade for women. It was a social business, a company of women, a company for women. There was a batch of companies in Britain started, the high-tech companies at that time. And everybody laughed, Manuela, because you couldn't sell software. It was given away free with the hardware. The sheer unusualness of a woman going into business, not selling hats or something.
But tell me how unusual it was.
Well, certainly in business, I thought I was the first. And years afterwards, I was more than irritated to discover that a woman in the States called Elsie Shutt had started a comparable computer software company.
So you weren't alone.
So I wasn't the first. I was only the second.
But tell me about the company that you then set up.
Because it was a woman's company, and the very first minute of the company's annals said that the employment policy shall be jobs for women with children.
And specifically with children?
Absolutely. Because this was intended to be home working, a 20th century cottage industry. But we finished up 8,500 people.
How many years later was that?
31 or something.
Tell me a bit about the kind of work you were doing with computers.
But the market was in commerce. Things like payroll, which apart from the size of some of the files, I found pretty boring. So I hit a compromise with operations research work. So we did lots and lots of stock control, program evaluation review techniques, scheduling buses or coaches, scheduling freight trains for British Rail.
Were there any men doing this kind of work at the time?
No.
It was seen as women's work.
Well, programming had come out of the clerical sector. It didn't have status in the early days. But as soon as everybody realized how important software was and how well paid it was, the men started to creep in, and the analysis of the work to be done and the consultancy and dealing with the users, that rather got separated out from the coding. And there was an element of pushing the coding work to the women and the high-level, more interesting stuff actually to the men. So one began to get some real...
divisions.
There were certainly divisions. And, of course, things like equal pay are very difficult when you've got that discriminatory employment policy.
But in your company, that wasn't happening because you were employing only women.
Well, of the first 300 staff, 297 were women. We never met. Was really working entirely with the simple telephone. And we would ask applicants, do you have access to a telephone? You know, because without a telephone, they wouldn't be considered for a job. And it didn't stay female-oriented forever, which is what I would have hoped for when I started, because we had equal opportunities legislation coming in Britain, and that was 1975.
So you had to employ men?
Well, it made our employment policy illegal, so we had to let the men in. From then on, it became well balanced between the sexes, which is as it should be.
But when did you start to notice that the field that you were working in was becoming more male?
For me, it was very obvious in the 80s. Very obvious.
That's quite late, really.
Yes. The computer world, though, was male-oriented. For example, I would be launching out business development letters by the dozen, basically introducing my company's services.
A touting for business, basically.
Yes, and got absolutely no reply whatsoever. So my dear husband suggested that I use the family nickname of Steve.
And so you posed as a man.
So, yes. At least I began to get some replies with exactly the same letters. A little frisson of excitement when I walked through the door and they realised that Steve was a lady.
Because there is a perception that tech was somehow kind of easier then.
I think it was quite a different level of difficulty because you didn't have computers to help you. You really had to maintain a concentration on a particular task without deviation and preferably without error over a matter of days and weeks, occasionally months. So it was very, very demanding. I never had difficulty in recruiting. I could take the pick and choose of women because quality companies like IBM, who had trained their systems engineers, of whom many were women, refused to let them work part-time. So as soon as they wanted to go part-time for family reasons, they all came to me.
So you send thank you notes to IBM. You must have had some very interesting conversations of the kind of support they were getting from their husbands, from their own families, interesting situations personnel-wise.
There was one woman I know who did a solid and very senior technical management role and would sort of tidy up at the end of each day, and she kept rigid hours. And I don't think her husband really knew that she worked.
She was working on the sly.
She was working on the sly in the home. Unbelievable.
Dame Stephanie Shirley. She ended up selling her company in the 1980s and doing very well out of it financially. But how typical is her story of women in the early days of tech? She mentioned that men gradually started getting more interested in computing jobs once they became more lucrative. And that's something Marie Hicks found in her research too. She's a historian of technology and gender and wrote a book called Programmed Inequality: How Britain Discarded Women Technologists and Lost Its Edge in Computing.
As computing professionalized, women didn't intentionally or willingly drop out. They were very, very carefully pushed out of jobs that were suddenly now aligned with management more than workers. The women who got pushed out of these technical jobs had all of the technical skills to do the work, and they were actually training their male replacements.
And what kind of technical work was it?
They ran the gamut from computer programming to systems analysis. And, you know, the computers that women were running in the British government and in British industry were doing everything from, you know, running the National Health Service, to atomic energy research, to more mundane things like figuring out when roads could be repaired to minimize traffic reduction.
It's really difficult to think of this as women's work, given the kind of culture that surrounds the whole tech industry at the moment. What was it then that made people think it was women's work?
People didn't really understand computers' power for the early part of this period. Computers were seen as though they were automating away skill, even though that wasn't necessarily the case. There's a term that's in use during the 50s and 60s, the industrialization of the office. And managers say things like, well, women are good for light industrial work, so they'll be good for running these machines that we're bringing into the office. They really saw this work as somehow rote, de-skilled, and, you know, low status and requiring very little intellect. And even though many managers recognized that wasn't the case, and it was that slow recognition, actually, that began to get people thinking in management that women should not actually be holding these jobs.
How did women react to try and counter this sexism towards them, or did they just accept it?
No, they didn't just accept it. One of the things that women did repeatedly was they organized into labor unions, women's associations, and they tried very, very hard to say, look, we are doing skilled work. We are doing important work. Please recognize that and also give us equal pay. Because for most of this period, not only were women being paid less than men, but oftentimes the highest pay that a woman could get in these jobs was about the same level or lower than the lowest pay that a man could get doing the very same job.
What lessons do you think there are for today in terms of getting more women into the tech industry, something that Silicon Valley in particular is struggling with?
I think that one of the lessons is that this idea of the STEM pipeline is really rotten, that if you get enough women into the early career stages in these fields, that they will, through dint of hard work, be able to rise up and come out the other end of the pipeline at very high levels, you know, in management. And this has been being tried for decades now, and it simply doesn't work. We don't have high numbers of white women and people of color in a lot of these fields, because there is a breakdown of meritocracy. It's not an accident. It's an anti-meritocratic system. And the pipeline model, that metaphor, it actually relies on meritocracy to be in place in order for people who are underrepresented to work their way up. One of the lessons for today is that we really have to think about getting women into computing jobs, into high-tech jobs at higher levels initially, getting people to make lateral moves from other industries. Because especially if you look at Silicon Valley, the higher up you go in the management hierarchy, the fewer technical skills you actually need or even expected to have.
Marie Hicks. She's clear there are big cultural and structural problems holding women back from jobs and job progression in the tech sector. And others argue this prejudice is reinforced online with an internet biased in favour of men. Take an example put forward by TED.com editor Emily McManus. She attempted an internet search to find an English student who taught herself calculus. Google's reply was, "Do you mean a student who taught himself calculus?" She took a screenshot of the search. It was retweeted thousands of times and became a worldwide news story. But does that indicate there is indeed a structural bias on the net? Joanna Bryson is an associate professor at Princeton's Center for Information Technology. She co-authored research last year that showed machine learning algorithms, the kind used in web searches, are picking up human race and gender prejudices.
The internet reflects our society, and I don't think there's strong evidence that it's worse than the rest of our society.
Okay, but these are algorithms that decide which images you see if you do a search, for example, on engineer, or if you do a search on nurse and you look at the images and all the images tend to be women when you do a search on nurse. So is there a case for changing the algorithms?
You're saying it's the algorithms, and it can be algorithms. In fact, there's countries that sit down and say, we don't want anyone to be able to see a woman that their hair isn't covered or something. And then they ban any images. So that is an algorithm. Someone's gone and written a thing that looks for women whose hair isn't covered and then tries to block them from the internet. Okay, so that's an algorithm. The stuff about that Googling nurse or whatever, that's not actually the algorithm, that's the data. So that's our society. And so what people are asking is, can we use algorithms to correct for society? So it's not that the algorithms are being unfair there. They're showing us something about ourselves that we don't want to know. I don't think it's a really great idea for us to ask companies or governments or whatever to change our society for us at that level. I mean, maybe that's what we do when we ask for affirmative action. We say we need a correction. But if we're going to do that algorithmically, we have to be very careful about how do we control it, who controls it.
Do people come to you with a moral argument about why this should change? Why these search engines should
absolutely
reflect on it? And what do you say to them?
So let's go back and talk about this a little bit. The research that we did that showed the sexism, it's based on the standard way that you find stuff on the web. You know, it's called latent semantic analysis. And that's how you can type a few words into a search engine and it can find the web page that's closest to the meaning of those few words. That's done with really simple arithmetic. There's nothing tricky there. It's just about counting the words on either side. I was at the Turing Institute in London. You know, a bunch of really smart people were saying to me, you can do with these counts, we call them vectors. So a vector is like a whole bunch of counts about a single word. With these vectors, you can do all kinds of silly tricks. If you can do those stupid tricks, why can't you do something important like eradicate prejudice? And the thing is, fairness is not a simple concept. Fairness is something we negotiate. That's a complex negotiation. It's not just arithmetic. So yes, people come to me with moral outrage, but there's a fact of the matter. And unfortunately, you know, the idea of enforcing one perspective on the world without a very careful democratic process behind that, no, I find that terrifying.
So it's
and
best
I don't
just
want
to leave
any country, any country or any company to have that much power.
Joanna Bryson, Associate Professor at Princeton Center for Information Technology. She brings us to the end of this edition of Business Daily. We're back again at the same time tomorrow. Once a week for the last 2.5 months, we've been releasing episodes of our major new podcast series, The Assassination. Now, all 10 episodes are available to listen to or to download. It's a decade-long investigation into the murder of one of the world's most well-known politicians, Benazir Bhutto. The podcast has been described by listeners as outstanding, one of the best, and as good as a podcast can be. To hear the whole series from the BBC World Service, search for The Assassination wherever you find your usual podcasts.